Chapter 19. Momum. Even though the skin spies were exposed relatively early in the course of the Holy War, most believed the Kisharim, rather than the consult, to be responsible. This is the problem of all great revelations. Their significance so often exceeds the frame of our comprehension. We understand only after, always after, not simply when it is too late, but precisely because it is too late. Drusus Acamian, Compendium of the First Holy War. Late Spring, 4111, Year of the Tusk, Momum. The Skilvendi racked her with his hunger, his countenance fierce and famished. Serwe felt his shudder as though through stone, then watched dully as he abandoned his appetite and rolled back into the tented darkness. She turned away toward the far side of the cavernous tent Proyas had given them. Wearing a simple gray smock, Kellas sat cross-legged next to a candle, hunched over a great tome, also given to them by Proyas.
"Why do you let him use me like this? I belong to you."
She ached to cry this aloud, but she could not. She could feel the Skilvendi's eyes upon her back, and if she turned, she was certain she would see them glow like a wolf's in torchlight. Serwe had recovered quickly over the past 2 weeks. The incessant ringing in her ears had disappeared, and the bruises had faded yellow-green. Deep breaths still pained her, and she could walk only with a limp, but these had become more an inconvenience than a debility. And she still carried his baby, Kellis's baby. That was the important thing. Proyas's physician, a tattooed priest of Akiagni, had marveled over this fact, giving her a small prayer chime with which to sound thanks to the god. "To show your gratitude," he had said, "for the strength of your womb." But she had no need of chimes to be heard in the outside, she knew. The outside had entered the world, had taken her, Serwe, as his lover. The day before she'd felt well enough to carry their laundry down to the river. She perched the woven basket upon her head, as she had when still owned by her father, and simply limped through camp until she found someone she could follow to the appropriate place along the river. Everywhere she walked, men of the Tusk laid bold eyes upon her. Though she was accustomed to such looks, she found herself at once thrilled, angered, and frightened. So many warlike men. Some even dared call out to her, often in tongues she couldn't understand, and always in crude terms that drew braying laughter from their companions.
"You think you limp now, eh, wench?"
Those times she dared meet their eyes, she'd think,
"I'm the vessel of another, one far mightier and far holier than you."
Most of them would be chastened by her fierce look, as though they could somehow sense the truth of her thought, but a few would glare until she looked away, their lust fanned rather than snuffed by her defiance, like the Skilvendi. None dared molest her, however. She was too beautiful, she realized, not to belong to someone of consequence. If only they knew. The encampment's dimensions had astonished her from the very first, but only when she joined the masses congregated along the bouldered banks of the River Phaeus did she truly understand the Holy War's immensity. Women and slaves, thousands of them, clotted the hazy distances, rinsing, scrubbing, adding to the endless staccato of wet cloth slapping against rocks. Pot-bellied wives waded into the brown river, scooping water to scrub at their armpits. Small groups of women and men laughed, gossiped, or sang simple hymns. Naked children darted through the confusion about her, crying,
"No, you, you!"
"I belong to this," she had thought. And now, tomorrow, they were going to march into Fainum lands. Serwe, daughter of a tributary Nimbrakani chieftain, would be part of a holy war against the Kianin. For Serwe, the Kianin had always been one among many mysterious, threatening names, not unlike Skilvendi. As a concubine, she'd overheard the Gonum sons speak of them now and again, their voices thick with contempt, but also hedged by admiration. They would discuss abortive embassies to the Padaraja in Nensifon, diplomatic feints, trivial successes and troubling setbacks. They would complain of the Emperor's flawed heathen policy, and the people and places they mentioned would all seem curiously unreal to her, as though a vicious and gritty extension of some child's fairy tale. Gossip with the slaves and other concubines, this was real. The fact that old Griassa had been caned the day before for spilling lemon sauce on the Patrodomo's lap, that Epeltros, the beautiful groom, had stolen into the dormitory and made love to Alsa, only to be betrayed by someone unknown and put to death. But that world was gone, snuffed out forever by Pantaruth and his Munuati. The unreal people and places had swept in cataracts through the narrow circle of her life, and now she walked with men who conferred with princes, emperors, even gods. Soon, very soon, she would see the magnificent grandees of Kian arrayed for battle, watch the fluttering banners of the Tusk storm the field. She could almost see Kellis in the midst of the fracas, glorious and unconquerable, striking down the shadowy Padiraja. Kellis would be the violent hero of this unwritten scripture. She knew this. With inexplicable certainty, she knew this. But now he looked so peaceful, bent by candlelight over an ancient text. Her heart racing, she crawled next to him, gathering her blanket tight around her shoulders and against her breasts. "What do you read?" she asked hoarsely. Then she began to weep, the memory of the Skilvendi still thick between her legs. "I'm too weak to suffer him." The gentle face looked up from the manuscript, somehow cold in the pale light. "I'm sorry for interrupting," she hissed through tears, her face pinched by a child's anguish, by submission awful and uncomprehending. "Where will I go?" But Kella said, "Don't run, Serwe." He spoke to her in Nimbrikani, the language of her father. This was part of the dark shelter they had built between them, the place where the wrathful eyes of the Skilvendi could not see. But at the sound of her native tongue, she was racked by sobs. "Often," he continued, touching her cheek and brushing her tears into her hair, "when the world denies us over and over, when it punishes us as it's punished you, Serwe, it becomes difficult to understand the meaning. All our pleas go unanswered. Our every trust is betrayed. Our hopes are all crushed. It seems we mean nothing to the world. And when we think we mean nothing, we begin to think we are nothing." A soft, crooning wail escaped her. She wanted to fall forward, to curl herself tighter and tighter until nothing remained. "But I don't see it." "The absence of understanding," Kellis replied, "is not the same as absence. You mean something, Serwe. You are something. This whole world is steeped in meaning. Everything, even your suffering, has sacred meaning. Even your suffering has a crucial role to play." She touched slack fingers to her neck. Her face crumpled.
"I mean something?"
"More than you can imagine," he whispered. She collapsed into his chest, and he held her as she soundlessly screamed. Then she howled her anguish, bawled as she had as a child, her body shuddering, her hands crushed between them. He rocked her in his arms, rolled his cheek against her scalp. After a time, he pressed her back, and she lowered her face for shame. So weak, so pathetic. With soft strokes, he dabbed the tears from her eyes, watched her for a long while. She didn't entirely calm until she saw the tears streaming from his own eyes.
"He cries for me, for me."
"You belong to him," he said at last. "You are his prize."
"No," she croaked defiantly. "My body's his prize. My heart belongs to you."
How had this happened? How had she been pried in two? She had endured much. Why this agony now, now that she loved? But for a moment, she almost felt whole, speaking their secret language, saying tender things.
"I mean something."
His tears slowed in his trim beard, gathered and then plummeted onto the open book, stained the ancient ink.
Your book,
she gasped, finding relief in a sense of guilt for an object of his concern. She leaned from her blanket, naked and ivory in the light, and ran her fingers across the open pages.
Is it ruined?
Many others have wept over this text, Kellis replied softly. The distance between their faces was close, humid, suddenly tense. She grasped his right hand, guided it to her perfect breasts.
Kellis, she whispered tremulously, I would have you come into me.
And at last he relented. Gasping beneath him, she looked into the dark corner where the Skjolvendi lay, knowing that he could see the rapture on her face, on their faces, and she cried out as she climaxed, a cry of hatred. Nayor lay still, his breath hissing between clenched teeth, the image of her perfect face, turning to him in anguished rapture, crowded the light wavering across the canvas slopes above. Serwe giggled girlishly, and Kellis murmured several things to her in that accursed tongue of hers. Linen and wool whisked over smooth skin, then the candle was snuffed, pitch black. They pressed through the flap, and the scent of fresh air wound through the pavilion's interior. She said, her voice thinned by open space and dulled by canvas, the rasp of charcoal as someone threw wood onto the fire. Arushina, bossa kalwe, Kellis replied. Serwe laughed some more, but in a husky, oddly mature way he'd never heard before.
Something more the bitch hides from me.
He groped in the darkness. His fingertips found the leather of his pommel. It was both cool and warm, like human skin bare to the chill of night. He lay still for several more moments, listening to the hushed counterpoint of their voices through the pop and rush of building flames. He could see the firelight now, a faint orange smear through the black canvas, a lithe shadow passed across it. Serwe. He raised the broadsword. It rasped from its sheath, a dull orange glimmer. Dressed only in his loincloth, he rolled from his blankets and padded across the mats to the pavilion entrance. He breathed heavily. Images from the previous afternoon flitted through his thoughts, the Dunyain and his bottomless scrutiny of the Enrithi nobles. The thought of leading the men of the Tusk into battle stirred something within him, pride perhaps. But he was under no illusion as to his true station. He was a heathen to these men, even to Nersey Proyas. And as time passed, that fact would come home to them. He would be no general, an advisor on the cunning ways of the Kianin, perhaps, but nothing more. Holy war. The thought still yanked a snort of breath from his nose, as though all war were not holy. But the question he now knew was not what he would be, but what the Dunyain would be. What terror had he delivered to these outland princes?
What will he make of the holy war?
Would he make it his whore, like Serwe? But this was the plan. 30 years, Kellis had said shortly after their arrival.
Moengus has dwelt among these men for 30 years.
He will have great power. More than either of us could hope to overcome. I need more than sorcery, Nayur. I need a nation, a nation. Somehow they would exploit circumstance, knot the harness about the holy war, and use it to destroy Anasarimber Moengus. How could he fear for these Enrithi, repent bringing the Dunyain to them, when this was their plan? But was this the plan? Or was it simply another Dunyain lie, another way to pacify, to gull, to enslave? What if Kellis was not an assassin sent to murder his father, as he claimed, but a spy sent to do his father's bidding? Was it simply a coincidence that Kellis traveled to Shaima just as the Holy War embarked on a campaign to conquer it? Nayor was no fool. If Moengus was Kisharim, he would fear the Holy War, and he would seek ways to destroy it. Could this be why he had summoned his son?
Kellis's obscure origins would allow him to infiltrate it as he already had, while his breeding or training or witchery or whatever it was would allow him to seize it, capsize it, perhaps even turn it against its maker, against Maythanet. But if Kellis served rather than hunted his father, then why had he spared him in the mountains? Nayor could still feel the impossible iron hand about his throat, the pitching depths beneath his feet. But I spoke true, Nayor. I do need you. Could he have known, even then, of Proyas's contest with the Emperor? Or did it just so happen that the Inrithi needed a Skilvendi? Unlikely, to say the least. But then how could Kellis have known? Nayor swallowed, tasted Serwe. Could it be that Moengus still communicated with him? The thought sucked all air from his lungs. He saw Zunarit, blinded, chained beneath the Emperor's heel.
Am I the same?
Still speaking that accursed tongue, Kellis teased Serwe some more. Nayor could tell because of Serwe's laugh, a sound like water rushing among the Dunyane's smooth stone words. In the blackness, Nayor extended his broadsword, pressed its tip through the flap, which he drew aside the width of a palm. He watched, breathlessly. Their faces firelight orange, their backs in shadow, the two of them reclined side by side on the barked olive trunk they used for a seat. Like lovers, Nayor studied their reflections across the smeared polish of his sword. By the dead god, she was beautiful, so like. The Dunyane turned and looked at him, his eyes shining. He blinked. Nayor felt his lips curl involuntarily, a pounding rush in his chest, throat, and ears.
She's my prize,
he cried voicelessly. Kellis looked to the fire. He had heard, somehow. Nayor let the flap fall shut, pinched golden light into blackness. Desolate blackness.
My prize.
A Kamian would never remember what he'd thought or the route he'd taken on his long walk from the Imperial precincts to the encamped Holy War. He suddenly found himself sitting in the dust amid the litter of celebration. He saw his tent, small and alone, mottled and weathered by many seasons, many journeys, and cast in the silent shadow of Zynemus's pavilion. The Holy War swept beyond it, a great canvas city, matting the distances with a confusion of flaps, guy ropes, pennants, and awnings. He saw Zynemus slumbering next to the gutted fire, his thick frame curled against the chill. The marshal had been concerned by the Emperor's peremptory summons, he supposed, and had waited all night by the fire, waited for a Kamian to come home. Home. Tears brimmed at that thought. He'd never had a home, a place that he could call mine. There was no refuge, no sanctuary for a man such as he, only friends scattered here and there, who for some unaccountable reason loved him and worried about him. He left Zynemus to his slumber. Today would be a demanding day. The great encampment of the Holy War would disassemble itself from within, the tents felled and rolled tight about poles, the baggage trains drawn up and heaped with gear and supplies. Then it would begin the arduous yet exultant march south, toward the land of the heathen, toward desperation and bloodshed, and perhaps even truth. In the gloom of his tent, he once again withdrew his parchment map, ignoring the tears that tapped against the sheet. He stared at the consult for some time, as though struggling to remember what the name meant, what it portended. Then, wetting his quill, he drew an unsteady diagonal line from it to the Emperor. Connected at last. For so long it had simply floated in its corner, more than the wreckage of ink than a name, touching nothing, meaning nothing, like the threats muttered by a coward after his tormentor had gone. No longer. The bitter apparition had bared its knuckled flesh, and the horror of what was and what might be had become the horror of now. This horror, his horror. Why? Why would fate inflict this revelation upon him? Was she a fool? Didn't she know how weak, how hollow he'd become? Why me? A selfish question, perhaps the most selfish of questions. All burdens, even those as demented as the apocalypse, must fall upon the shoulders of someone. Why not him? Because I'm a broken man. Because I long for a love I cannot have. Because... But that road was far too easy. To be frail, to be afflicted with unrequited longing, was simply what it meant to be man. When had he acquired this penchant to wallow in self-pity? Where in life's slow accumulation had he come to see himself as the world's victim? How had he become such a fool? After 300 years, he, Drusus Acamian, had rediscovered the consort. After 2,000 years, he, Drusus Acamian, had witnessed the return of an Anassarimbor. Anatki, the whore of fate, had chosen him for these burdens. It wasn't his place to ask why, nor could such questions relieve him of his burden. He had to act, choose his moment and overcome, overwhelm. He was Drusus Acamian. His song could char legions, tear the earth asunder, pull dragons shrieking from the sky. But even as he returned his scrutiny to the parchment, a great hollow opened in the heart of his momentary resolution, like the stillness that chased ripples across the surface of a pool, drawing them thinner and thinner. And in the wake of this hollow, voices from his dreams, nagging half-remembered fears, the fog of inarticulate regret. He had rediscovered the consort. But he knew nothing of their plans, nor of any way to discover them again. He didn't even know how they'd been discovered by the Emperor in the first place. They concealed themselves in a way that could not be seen. The single tremulous line joining the consort to the Emperor was devoid of any significance, save that they were somehow connected. And if the consort had infiltrated the Imperial Court with this skin spy, he could only assume that they had likewise infiltrated all the great factions, the entire Three Seas, perhaps even the Mandate itself. A face opening like palsied fingers from a skinless palm. How many were there? Suddenly the name, the consort, which had been so isolated from the others, seemed spliced to them in a terrifying intimacy. The consort hadn't just infiltrated factions, Acamian realized. They had infiltrated individuals to the point of becoming them. How does one war against such a foe without warring against what they've become, without warring against all the great factions? For all Acamian knew, the consort already ruled the Three Seas and merely tolerated the Mandate as an impotent foe, a laughingstock, in order to further fortify the bulwark of ignorance that shielded them. How long have they been laughing? How far has their corruption gone? Could it have reached as far as the Shrya? Could the Holy War, at its pith, be an artifact of the consort? A cascade of heart-pounding implications flushed through him, beating his skin with a cold sweat of dread. Disconnected events found themselves woven into a narrative far darker than ignorance, the way disjoint ruins might be bound by the intuition of some lost bastion or temple. Gishruni's missing face. Did the consort murder him? Take his face to consummate some obscene rite of substitution, only to be thwarted when the Scarlet Spires discovered his body shortly after? And if the consort knew of Gishruni, would that not also mean they knew of the secret war between the Scarlet Spires and the Kishorim? And wouldn't that explain how Mathanet also knew of the war? Explain Inrao's death? If the Shrya of the Thousand Temples was a consort spy, if the prophecy of the Anassarimbor... He looked to the parchment once again, to Anassarimbor Kellis, still disconnected, though in troubling proximity to the consort. He raised his quill, about to scratch a line between the two names, but hesitated. He set the quill down. The man, Kellis, who would be his student and his friend, was so unlike other men. The Anassarimbor's return was a harbinger of the second apocalypse. The truth of this ached in Acamian's bones, and the Holy War would simply be the first great shedding of blood. His head swimming, Akamian pulled a stunned hand over his face, through his hair. Images of his former life, teaching Proyas algebra by scratching figures into the earth of a garden path, reading a Genesis in the fretted morning sunlight of Zin's portico, brawled through his thoughts, hopelessly innocent, poignantly wan and naive, and utterly wrecked. The second apocalypse is here. It has already begun. And he stood in the very heart of the tempest, the Holy War. Deranged shadows frolicked and cavorted along the canvas walls of his tent, and Akamian knew with appalling certainty that they plumbed the horizon, that some measureless frame had stolen unawares upon the world and fixed its dreadful course. Another apocalypse, and it's happening. But this was mad. It couldn't be. It is. Breathe in. Now exhale. Slowly. You're a match for this, Akka. You must be a match for this. He swallowed. Ask yourself, what is the question? Why would the Consult want this holy war? Why would they want to destroy the Phanum? Does it have something to do with the Kishorum? But in the relief of posing this question, a second stole into his thoughts, one whose terminus was too painful for him to deny, a thought like a winter knife. They murdered Geshruni immediately after I left Carathuzal. He thought of the man in the Kampoja Agora, the one who he'd thought had been following him, the one who had seemed to change his face. Does that mean they're following me? Had he led them to Inrao? Akamian paused, breathless in the diffuse light, the parchment numb and tingling in his left hand. Had he also led them? He brought two fingers to his mouth, drew them slowly to and fro along his lower lip. Esme, he whispered. Lashed together, the pleasure galleys swelled gently on the Menenor outside of Momum's fortified harbor. It was a tradition, centuries old, to gather thus at the feast of Kusapukari, which marked the summer solstice. Most of those on the galleys were of the two high castes, the Kaijaneta of the houses of the congregate and the priestly Nahat, men from House Gonum, House Daskus, House Legesaris, and many others, gauged one another and tailored their gossip according to the murky webs of loyalty and enmity that bound the houses together. Even within the castes, there were 1,000 increments of rank and reputation. The official criteria for such rank were clear, more or less. Nearness to the emperor, which was easily measured by the hierarchy of stations within his labyrinthine ministries, or, at the opposite pole, affiliation with House Biaxi, the traditional rival of House Aikyori. But the houses themselves had long histories, and rank between men was inextricably bound to history. So concubines and children would be told, that man, Trimus Carcharius, defer to him, child. His ancestors were once emperors, even though House Trimus was out of favor with the emperor and had been despised by the Biaxi since time immemorial. Add to this the measures of wealth, of learning, and of wit, and the genetic codes that braced all their intercourse became as indecipherable from the outside as they were bewildering from within, a shrouded bog that quickly devoured the stupid. But this welter of hidden concerns and instant calculation did not constrain them. It was simply the way, as natural as the cycle of constellations. The fluid things of life were no less necessary for being fluid. So the revelers laughed and talked as though careless, leaning against polished rails, basking in the perfection of the late afternoon sun, shivering when they fell into shadows. Bowls rang, wine was poured and spilled, making sticky-ringed fingers even stickier. The first swallow was spat into the sea, propitiation to Momus, the god who provided the ground of these proceedings. The conversations were a wash of humor and gravity, like a promenade of voices, each vying for attention, each hinged on the opportunity to impress, to inform, to entertain. The concubines, dressed in their silk culotti, had been driven away by the harsh talk of the men, as was proper, and wallowed in those subjects they found endlessly amusing: fashion, jealous wives, and willful slaves. The men, carefully holding their anonai sleeves so they fell into the sun, spoke of serious things, and regarded with amused disdain anything that fell outside the realm of war, prices, and politics. Those few breaches of Jinan risked were tolerated, even encouraged, depending on who made them. It was part of Jinan to know precisely when to transgress it. The men laughed hard at the sounds of obligatory shock that passed through the women within earshot. Around them, the waters of the bay were hard blue and flat. Looking like toys in the distance, Galeoth grain ships, immense Sarangi carracks, and others moored outside the mouth of the River Phaeus. The afterstorm sky felt deep with clarity. Toward land, the shallow hills surrounding Momem were brown, and the city itself looked old, like the ashes of a fire. Through the perpetual haze of smoke, the great monuments of the city could be discerned, like darker shadows hunching over the gray smudge of tenements and chaotic alleyways. As always, the Tower of Ziek oppressed the northeast, and in the city's heart, the great domes of Zothe rose above the confused temple complex of Kamiral. The keen-sighted among the Biaxi faction swore that in the midst of the temples they could see the Emperor's Cock, as Zarius's latest monument had come to be called. Controversy ensued. There were some, the more religious, who balked at this bawdy joke, but they were swayed by more argument and more wine. They were forced to concede that the obelisk, after all, possessed a wrinkled head. One of the drunkards among them even drew his knife, the first real breach of etiquette, when it was recalled that he'd kissed the obelisk the previous week. It was outside the walls of Momem where things had changed. The surrounding fields were dust, trampled gray by countless feet and textured by sun-baked ruts. The land had broken beneath the weight of the holy war. The groves were dead, cesspits festered, flies. The holy war had marched, and the men of the houses discussed it endlessly, recounted the Emperor's humiliation, no, the Empire's humiliation, at the hands of Proyas and his mercenary Skilvendi. A Skilvendi? Would the fiends now hound them on the field of politics as well? The great names had called the Emperor's bluff, and though Icuri Zarius had threatened not to march with the Holy War, he had in the end conceded defeat and sent Confis with them. The attempt to bend the holy war to Nansur interests had been a daring gambit, they all agreed. But so long as the brilliant Confis marched with them, the Emperor might still succeed. Confis, a man like a god, a true child of Kyrenius or even Kinney, of the old blood, how could he fail to make the holy war his own? "Think of it," they cried. "The old empire restored." And they raised yet another toast to their ancient nation. Most had spent the pestilence months of spring and summer at their provincial estates and had seen little of the men of the Tusk. Some had grown wealthy supplying the holy war, and even more had precious sons under Confis. They had few practical reasons to celebrate the march of the holy war south, but perhaps their considerations were deeper. When the locusts descended, they grew rich, emptying their granaries, but they still burned offerings when the famines ended. The gods detested nothing so much as arrogance. The world was painted glass. Shadows of ancient, unimaginable power shifted beneath. Somewhere distant, the holy war traveled the roads between ancient capitals, a great migration of sturdy men and sun-glittering arms. Even now, some claimed they could hear its horns faint through laughing voices and the stationary sea, the way the peal of trumpets might linger in ringing ears. Others paused and listened, and though they heard nothing, they shivered and rationed their words with care. If glories witnessed moved men to awe, glories asserted but not seen moved them to piety and judgment.